Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message.
Today, you get the opportunity to hear from Stan Mitchell, who, if you haven't heard, is the newest member of the Eastlake staff. So go ahead and welcome Stan Mitchell.
Thank you, gang. Well, nothing, it doesn't feel like things have changed. It just feels like I will be here a little more often or a lot more often. So grateful to be a part of this community. Again, I feel like I've been a part of this community for a good while now. I think I always had a sense that I would end up to some degree here more. I didn't know when that would happen or how that would happen. So just suffice to say, I'm grateful. Ryan and Michelle were in Nashville 2 weeks ago, and he spoke at Grace Point for us. And when he got up, he was saying some really nice things about me, which I liked. And as he was saying them, I was kind of getting lost in the moment and how much I meant to him. And then he concluded his remarks by saying that he really liked the things that I had to say, and that he really intently listened to me, and that he had to intently listen because sometime the words were drowned out by the sound of banjos in the background. I've been working for 2 weeks to think of something that would be commensurate to that, and I haven't come up with it yet, but I will. I will. Rabbi, thank you. Thank you. I am reminded every time I meet wide-hearted, my brothers and sisters, wide-hearted from your community, how terribly wrong our sense of supersessionism and extending beyond and growing greater than you were, little by little and more, the deeper I go into our Rabbi Jesus, the more deeply I realize we have not superseded. We are simply growing into Jeremiah's new heart with all of you. It's the same call. It's the same call. And I appreciate your words. I was deeply moved and don't know what I can say after them. Blessed are the pure in heart, Jesus said, for they shall see God. This is the sixth of Jesus' Beatitudes, and frankly, it has as many interpretations as it has interpreters. Just the individual words themselves, blessed, pure, heart, see, God. In their individual status, these words are complex with possibilities. Even more complex are they when they are joined into phrases and sentences. You see, reading and interpreting the words of a historic wisdom teacher like Jesus, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Reading and interpreting those words that were originally set in a much different time and a much different place is of course a very different experience in the now than it would have been hearing those same words from that teacher's lips in their original context. There are nuances always that are embedded in our communication that are beyond the acute definition of words. Nuances that are embedded in the time and in the place. Of course, those nuances make our experience of those words very differently than the experiences of those, or very different than the experience of those who heard them from the teacher's lips in their original context. These nuances embedded in the original setting were understood by the speaker and by the hearers. They were understood. They didn't have to be explained. But those same nuances over time, this is the science of hermeneutics or interpretation, those same nuances are inevitably lost or at least eroded with the passing of time. So to that end, all of us who trained in ministry were trained in this science of hermeneutics, and we were taught that it is an informative exercise, a necessary exercise, to recover as many of those lost nuances as possible when you're reading literature from another context. But I want to add this morning to that, that this forensic, academic, rational approach of mining an ancient context for those nuances, those idiosyncrasies of culture and language, that forensic, rational approach to an ancient or distant text isn't the only way to beneficially approach a text. And the longer I live, and the more wide-hearted and liberal I become in my spirituality and faith, I think that forensic approach is not even the best of approaches. Perhaps just as effective of an interpretive method is for me to approach a text and to commit myself to humbly and curiously and imaginatively and creatively and even simply open my hands and my heart and my mind, beginner's mind, if you will, and to allow the text to be explored as a living, breathing, benevolent reality that has the capacity to transcend a specific context and unfold itself almost infinitely in any number of settings, including mine. And to approach the text looking for perhaps, and this is new to me, to approach the text looking for perhaps the simplest and most relevant meaning for my life today. Ironically, I think that this beginner's mind approach to a text not only works well with our present text, but actually is exactly what this present text, Matthew 5 and 8, was getting at. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see. Per the matter of approaching sacred text with humble curiosity and a beginner's mind, I think, frankly, that the same approach can be applied to life in general. I think Frederick Buechner was right. Life is itself a text. And the events and the occurrences, the things that happen, the people we meet, the books we read, the places we go to, these, Buechner said, are the alphabet of grace that are juxtaposed by God into words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs and chapters. This alphabet of grace becomes our life. It is perhaps the most sacred of all text, incarnation, we call it. And so we're to come to this text, the text of life, just as curiously and openly and wide-eyed and wide-hearted, expectantly, as we are to come to a sacred text, a sacred written text. To that end, I think Jesus agreed, because Jesus said in another place outside of the Beatitudes, if a person wanted to see, there's that word, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Jesus said if a person really wanted to see and enter into what in that context was called the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God, variously. That word kingdom has some trouble for a lot of us today. We feel it's a bit anachronistic, not just politically, but perhaps it's anachronistic even in terms of gender. But Jesus was saying, if a person really wants to see and enter, call it the beloved community, the domain of ultimate reality, the ground of all being. Paul Tillich called it the new creation, the holy union. If a person really wants to see the really real, then the person would need to be humble. Dare we say, humble themselves in the most positive sense of that word, humus, earth, ground. They would need to ground themselves, and Jesus said, become as a little child. Per Jesus, a child's eyes have a better chance of seeing the important stuff than the eyes of the typical adult. Except you become as a child, you can't see, Jesus said. In another place, Jesus said something very similar when he said, in order to see the kingdom, there it is again, the beloved community, to be enlightened, to be saved. Every religion has its lexicon of terms. But in order To enter that really real, Jesus looked at one man, Nicodemus, under a sycamore tree with the Judean moon shining through its branches, and Jesus whispered, "You got to be born again." Nicodemus fell back on the ring ropes, punch drunk from this powerful message, and said, "How can a man be born again the second time? Can he enter into his mother's womb again and be born?" Jesus laughed and said, "Oh, Nicodemus, except a man is born of water, amniotic fluid, except a man is born of water, flesh, earthy, and a man is born of spirit, he can't see this thing, the really real, the ultimate reality." You see, this ideal disposition of soul, of heart, of mind, Jesus described it in several ways. He described it as being born again. He described it as new birth. He described it as becoming again as a child. One day he healed a blind man and he looked at the other standing there and he said, "This man's physical blindness was in its own way fortuitous." And maybe those who don't have ocular blindness, maybe they're the most blind of all, because somehow in the limitations of that, the poverty of life it has created has led him to the kingdom. Jesus described this disposition of soul as being born again, as becoming again as a little child. And in this morning's beatitude, I think synonymously, he described it as being pure of heart. All of these, Jesus said, lead to seeing. But to employ the specific language of today's text, the pure heart is the child's heart. The pure heart is the child's heart in its truest and best sense. The pure heart is the undivided heart. The pure heart is the heart cleansed of those things that blur its vision. The pure heart, the uncorrupted heart, the heart of new birth. That heart is the imago Dei, the image of God, the spark of the divine that resides at the center of every person. Life has a way, though. Afternoons or mornings in Pittsburgh have a way of bombarding. The vicissitudes of life have a way of bombarding and layering the heart with unhealthy accretions, calluses. And part of our soul work is to deal with these layers that layer themselves on over time, these wounds that layer themselves, that callous the heart. This perhaps was what Jesus was referring to when he referred to a hard heart. Perhaps the hard heart is not the willful, evil soul, which I'm believing less and less in these days, but the calluses that come through tender wounds that were not healed properly. The scar tissue that can be as life-threatening at times as the cancer. This is the hard heart. And Jesus, in calling us back to the womb of our mother, the mother, Jesus, in calling us to new birth and childlikeness and the heart that's pure, the same call of the prophet Jeremiah, the same call of the psalmist in the 24th chapter, the same call of Moses to the people. Our work is to recapture a pure heart, and thankfully, we are equipped for that work. And it doesn't require an external invasion of a foreign god. Rather, the work of purifying our hearts is a process of internal exploration and a process of return. The work of purifying our hearts, if I understand our wisdom literature, is a work of remembering, becoming pure of heart, becoming again as a child, going back again to a new birth. This is a work that is more about returning home and less about reuniting with God. You remember the prodigal's moment of conversion was not when he came to God. We've built an entire religion the first 2,000 years telling people they need to return to God and come back to God. And yet the prodigal's moment of conversion is an archetype for all of us. His moment of conversion was not when he came to God. The Bible said he came to himself. You say, well, what about coming again to God? He couldn't come to God because God had never left. Apologies to Pascal. There is no such thing as a God-shaped blank. God has never voided himself from us. Our union with the divine is impossible to break. So the prodigal salvation was him awakening. The Bible said in the hog pen, he awakened to an identity that he had always possessed but never appreciated and ascribed. This is salvation. Not a linear journey from child of the devil to child of God, but a circular journey of coming home to who you were born, appropriating and ascribing that which you had never fully understood. The prodigal salvation was about awakening to an identity that he possessed, and the same was true of the elder brother. Remember the words of the father spoken to him as the eldest son sat outside of the welcome home party for the younger brother. Sitting up on a hillside, the father went to him. Sitting down beside him, the young man with his eyes glimmering with tears, his jaw clenched. His father asked him why he was not at the party for his younger brother, and begrudgingly, he looked at his father and said, this kid hurt you and mom. He wasted his life. He spent your money. And I've been here slaving for you my whole damn life. And you've never so much as given me a goat. And the father's heart broke, and he looked at the boy and said, oh, son, have you not known that you have always been with me? And everything that I've ever had has always and ever been yours. A prodigal goes to the far country to be enslaved. An elder brother stays on the front row of the church and synagogue and is enslaved in his mind. Both have the same journey of salvation, one from afar and one from near. And perhaps the one near had psychically the hardest journey. This is why Jesus said the Pharisees and the broken will actually enter the kingdom ahead, not instead, but ahead of religious leaders, because people like me can be so inoculated by bits of the real until we don't catch it in its full. One comes home from the far country, the other comes home from home. Salvation was, Jesus was saying, and is a remembering. It's a coming home. It's a coming to ourselves. It's a digging. This is salvation. It is digging through the layers of life to discover our pure heart. When Jesus said, except you become as a child, I promise you, he was not speaking about an ideal, abstract child archetype. He was talking about the child that's inside of you, because the years of your life are not like calendar pages that are ripped off and thrown away. They are like the concentric rings of a tree that become the xylem through life, through which life still flows. At 50, I did not cease being 49, but at 50, I am 49 and 48 and 47 and 46. The child that we must become is the child inside that we are, that is still deserving to be at the table of grace that we feed from every day. It was the Catholic priest Henry Nouwen, who in retrospect now we look back on his life, this priest of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, post-Vatican II, but still incapable and not allowed to own his own identity, his own sexuality as a gay man. One of Henry's biographers, Henry Nouwen is one of the three most important writers in my life. No one ever exposed me to the heart of God and the true meaning of love and religion the way Henry Nouwen did. And yet one of Henry Nouwen's biographers wrote, reflecting on that tormented man, that tormented gay Catholic priest who could never make peace with himself internally or externally. In 43 books, Henry never said one thing about his sexuality, and yet it was there dripping between every line. The biographer said of Henry's prolific work on the love of God, Henry wrote 43 books that he could never ultimately live, and he lived a book with his life that he could never ultimately write. Now, at midlife, in a breakdown, an unrequited relationship with another man finally led him to dissolution. in terrible psychic breakdown, he went to La Arche Community in Toronto to hide away and to serve the elements, to serve the Eucharist to mentally and physically disabled, challenged, hurting adults. One particular man that he gave himself to for over a year, lived with him, took him with him wherever he went, was a man named Adam, who couldn't speak, who couldn't feed himself. It was in that place that Henry, ultimately broken down, trying to make peace with himself, said he lay on the floor one night and he cried out to God, "Oh God, I want to come home." Only to hear ultimately the voice of God say to him, "Come home, Henry." And then a vision unfolded of God standing at the front of a small cottage, but the small cottage was flesh-toned and pulsating. Now, and said he realized that that cottage was his heart, and God swung the doors open and said, "Come home, Henry." Henry said, "I looked at my heart, that heart that I had been trying to escape since I was an adolescent boy, since I was a small child, wrestling with the exclusions of the church and yet the longings of my own heart, wrestling to please God and yet knowing I was inherently crippled to do that." Henry said, he said, "I stared at that door with the Father standing saying, 'Come home.' And he said, I screamed, 'Oh God, I can't live there. I cannot live in my own heart.' To which the Father smiled and said, 'Oh Henry, I'm God. I have lived here since the day you were born. If your heart can be home to the divine, surely it can be home to you. Come home.'"
Everyone, excuse the interruption for a quick minute. My name is Kristen. I'm one of the team members here at Eastlake, and we're so glad that you're joining us today on the podcast. It's been so encouraging for us to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening to these messages and resonating with this idea that we just keep saying over and over again, which is life is a gift and love is the point, and that we are all committed to being a beneficial presence in our own communities. So thanks for joining us. I hope that that's resonating with you. It's just really fun for us. So wanted to also say thank you to those of you who contribute. This place, all of these things that we do are happening because of people who make consistent, even just small consistent gifts. It helps us plan. It helps us know that there are really people behind us who want this thing to continue. So thank you to those of you who do that. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that if you find this beneficial in your own life. To make a contribution, it's really easy. You can go to eastlakecc.com and there's a donate button there with all the info. So thanks so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
Salvation is not a linear journey to become something you're not. Salvation is a circular journey, if there is such a thing, of coming home to who you are and always have been. If there is a gospel, it is not to tell the world that it must be saved. It is to tell every last man, woman, boy, and girl that they have always been safe and they should live into that safeness with great affection and love. Sages and religions have described this experience of coming home, of becoming again a child, of being born again, of coming back to pure heart. They've described this experience in many ways, labeling it with many names, but perhaps my favorite description and my favorite nomenclature was given by the renowned French philosopher Jean-Paul Gustave Ricoeur. Ricoeur gave us the phrase second naivete. In his work, Ricoeur described a three-stage process that every human being must go through. It is a process of intellectual spiritual maturation. Ricoeur described those three stages, listen, as the pre-critical phase of life, the critical phase of life, and the post-critical phase of life. Pre-critical, critical, and post-critical. Synonymously, he described that same process as first naivete, sophistication, and second naivete. Ron Rollheiser, a Catholic priest, gave several other ways of describing the same universal maturation process. I love this. Listen to these. First fervor, disillusionment, mature love. Innocence, loss of innocence, new innocence. I like this one. For all you that came from evangelical backgrounds of purity culture, here we go. Virgin, experienced, re-virginized. Anybody have to sit through a covenant ring ceremony? Oh God, didn't we all want to get re-virginized? Childish, sophisticated, childlike. Young fool, old fool, holy fool. I like this one. Happy, unhappy, happy. I would add to that list, oh Lord, I tell you what, I'm gonna give you a Tennessee right now. Some of this stuff is so good. It's like, we used to say, it's like gristle. The more you chew on it, the bigger it gets. The good news is I'm going to come back and back and back and be here again and again. So I'm not going to try to cram all this in. We'll do part two later. But listen, Walter Brueggemann, in describing the Psalms, he described the three steps as orientation, disorientation, reorientation. Naive, inherited faith, tested faith, refined faith. Psalm 21, the king is on his throne. Everything works the way it's supposed to. Giants are felled by stones. Shepherd's staffs drive away the wolves and bears. Everything works out. Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. Still waters, green pastures, sure. Valleys of the shadow of death. Yes. Table spread absolutely in the presence of mine enemy, for sure. Naive orientation, disorientation, mature orientation. The Paschal cycle that is not only germane to Christianity, but to our roots, life, death, resurrection. And currently, the very common and recognizable words that this church knows well, deconstruction, deconstruction, reconstruction. To understand first naivete, one must first understand its backdrop. The first two stages of first naivete and sophistication. First naivete, or what Ricoeur called the pre-critical phase of life. I told Michelle and I, when we were on the way over, Dodge or Ace, one of them was talking about the elves, the magic elves that move around their house every night. I don't know what IGMO came up with that idea, but for about 8 years, I had to move 6 or 7 elves every night creatively to fascinate my child every morning, only for them to find out with great dismay and disappointment that it was all a ruse. Oh, the bitterness of adolescence. But the pre-critical phase of life, the pre-critical phase of life, first naivete, is the stage of life marked by the Pollyannic idealism of a child. It is the world, forgive me for dating myself, of chitty chitty bang bang, bed knobs and broomsticks and Mary Poppins. First naivete is the magical, mythical way of seeing the world around you. It is an idealism that inevitably is confronted and dismantled as unrealistic understandings and unfounded beliefs reluctantly and painfully are forced to give way to reality, science, and reason. Construction eventually yields deconstruction. First naivete eventually yields, through the birth pangs of disappointment and dismay, sophistication, critical thought, disorientation. Ultimately, magic, myth, and superstition are met with analysis, suspicion, skepticism, empiricism, criticism, and the like. Childish assumptions are confronted, Childhood constructs are dismantled, often to the dismay of the child, and a sadness can set in. Grief, even. Sadly, for those of us raised in fundamentalist religious settings of any ilk, this process of confrontation and dismantling that should have happened in adolescence and teen years is suspended even into our 30s and 40s. Every day, my inbox is filled, and part of that filling is from evangelical, traditional, conservative Christian preachers around this country who at 40 and 45 and 50 years old are finally confronting critical thought, doing work that they should have done before careers were set and children were had, marriages were made, and churches were built. Grief can set in the deconstruction process. And as Kubler-Ross tells us, grief that is not resolved healthily can fester into the infection of resentment, anger, ultimately become gangrenous in bitterness and cynicism. Unprocessed grief and dismay from the deconstruction process can be unbearable for those of us that came from fear-based notions of God. And the unprocessed or unmetabolized grief that comes with losing first naivete, when you had such certainty about God and where you were going and what happened after you died and whose side God was on, that kind of unprocessed and unmetabolized grief that comes with losing first naivete can lead to anger and resentment and bitterness and cynicism. Anyone in this room ever felt those sentiments and emotions in your spiritual religious deconstruction? Anybody ever said, as I have, sometimes I just want to go back to the ease of certainty. I just wanted to go back, and yet I don't. For some, this sophisticated, smart cynicism becomes the fixed lens through which they forever see life. And there are a lot of people from fundamentalist backgrounds, from religious backgrounds, who once first naivete is lost, for them, sophistication, critical thought, deconstruction is the last stage of the process. And a smart cynicism and intellectual sophistication becomes the fixed lens through which they ever see life. Jesus and all of the great wisdom teachers knew and know that cynicism or intellectual sophistication as an ultimate response to first naivete's loss is at least incomplete. And if a final destination is ultimately damaging. This, Jesus would offer, is the way of the immature, the way of the fool. This is why he called us to become again as a child. To be born again. To return to pure-heartedness. There's no way around it. First naivete must come to an end. And the stage of criticism, deconstruction, or sophistication is a necessary stage. But it's just that, it's a stage. Rabbi, it does not give me the equipment of heart and soul to deal with that list that you put up today. Cynicism, deconstructive reductionism, intellectual sophistication. Ultimately, the disappointments and the wounds and the loneliness and the absence of comfort that comes with that kind of sophistication, the critical phase, the deconstructive phase, it must be exposed to the antibodies of love and humility and curiosity and healing and raw honesty and courage. And then the jaded, hard-bitten soul can be opened for an even better phase. The tenderness of grief, the infection of anger, the swell of resentment that so many deconstructed evangelicals, Orthodox Jews, fundamentalist Muslims, Whatever the religion, fundamentalism is always the same. It damages and it wounds. But those wounds can be slowly and surely turned. If Jesus offers, one is willing to step into the realm of beginner's mind, of new birth, of digging through the accretions and calluses to find pure heart. I'll tell you more about this at another time, but I want to close with this. At only 24 years of age, Roberta Joan Mitchell, Joni Mitchell, wrote what for me is one of the finest pieces of lyrical art written in my lifetime. A song that magically illustrates the journey from first naivete through the labor pains of cynicism to the rebirth of a soul in second naivete. She began writing the song in March of 1967 while sitting in a plane high above the clouds. Her words, "I was reading Saul Bellow's Henderson the Rain King on a plane, and early in the book, Henderson the Rain King is also up in a plane. He's on his way to Africa, and he looks down and sees these clouds. I put down the book, looked out the window, and saw clouds too. And at the age of 20 years old, I immediately started writing the song. I had no idea that the song would become what it did." The song would come to be titled Both Sides Now. And I want you to listen to its three verses describe first clouds, then love, and then ultimately life. And it will describe these three things as they are processed through the lens of first naivete, cynicism or sophistication, and finally, redemptively, second naivete. Rows and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. And Seattle said amen. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow, it's clouds' illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds at all. Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, the dizzy dancing way that you feel as every fairy tale comes real. I've looked at love that way. But now it's just another show. You leave them laughing when you go. And if you care, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow it's love's illusions I recall. I really don't know love at all. Tears and fears and feeling proud to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. But now, old friends, they're acting strange. They shake their heads. They tell me that I've changed. Well, something's lost, but something's gained in living every day. I refuse to be the narrow-minded conservative or the loose-minded liberal who demand that there is only way to make progress, and that is either to go forward into a Pollyannic vision of the future or go backwards into an over-idealized, sentimentalized, perfected past that was not so. The reality is somewhere in the middle, at the heart of our religion, there is this willingness to always go back into childhood and to not recapture the silliness of misguided ideas and mythology, but to capture the beauty. And when that little girl looked at me and said, "Daddy, you lied to me," and was angry for a month when she found out the truth about Christmas, I remember ultimately telling her, "You can't understand it now, but one day you will. I believe in Santa Claus more than I ever have." This, brothers and sisters, is second naivete. This is new birth. And this, Jesus said, is what it means to have a pure heart, and it will allow you to get past the tears, and you will see God. Let's still our hearts now and comply and open them before we go. Settle these things into our heart, sweetest Christ, dearest Creator God, settle these things into our heart. May we look wide-eyed with informed eye. May our hearts be rejuvenated. Take us back to wonder and awe. We pray these things, trusting love eternal. And everyone said, Amen.